The Synthesis of Yoga, Sri Aurobindo. Continuing in Part 2, The Yoga of Integral Knowledge, Chapter 5, Renunciation, page 326. If discipline of all the members of our being by purification and concentration may be described as the right arm of the body of yoga, renunciation is its left arm. By discipline or positive practice, we confirm in ourselves the truth of things, truth of being, truth of knowledge, truth of love, truth of works, and replace with these the falsehoods that have overgrown and perverted our nature. By renunciation, we seize upon the falsehoods, pluck up their roots, and cast them out of our way, so that they shall no longer hamper, by their persistence, their resistance, or their recurrence, the happy and harmonious growth of our divine living. Renunciation is an indispensable instrument of our perfection. How far shall this renunciation go? What shall be its nature? And in what way shall it be applied? There is an established tradition, long favored by great religious teachings and by men of profound spiritual experience, that renunciation must not only be complete as a discipline, but definite and final as an end, and that it shall fall nothing short of the renunciation of life itself and of our mundane existence. Many causes have contributed to the growth of this pure, lofty, and august tradition. There is, first, the profounder cause of the radical opposition between the sullied and imperfect nature of life in the world, as it now is, in the present stage of our human evolution, and the nature of spiritual living. And this opposition has led to the entire rejection of world existence as a lie, an insanity of the soul, a troubled and unhappy dream, or at best a flawed, specious, and almost worthless good, or to its characterization as a kingdom of the world, the flesh, and the devil, and therefore, for the divinely led and divinely attracted soul, only a place of ordeal and preparation, or at best, a play of the all-existence, a game of cross-purposes which he tires of and abandons. A second cause is the soul's hunger for personal salvation, for escape into some farther or farthest height of unalloyed bliss and peace, untroubled by the labor and the struggle, or else it is unwillingness to return from the ecstasy of the divine embrace into the lower field of work and service. But there are other slighter causes incidental to spiritual experience. Strong feeling and practical proof of the great difficulty, which we willingly exaggerate into an impossibility of combining the life of works and action with spiritual peace, and the life of realization, or else the joy which the mind comes to take in the mere act and state of renunciation, as it comes indeed to take joy in anything that it has attained, or to which it has inured itself, and the sense of peace and deliverance which is gained by indifference to the world and to the objects of man's desire. Lowest causes of all are the weakness that shrinks from the struggle, the disgust and disappointment of the soul baffled by the great cosmic labor, the selfishness that cares not what becomes of those left behind us, so long as we personally can be free from the monstrous, ever-circling wheel of death and rebirth, the indifference to the cry that rises up from a laboring humanity. For the sadhaka of an integral yoga, none of these reasons are valid. with weakness and selfishness, however spiritual in their guise or trend, he can have no dealings. A divine strength and courage, and a divine compassion and helpfulness, are the very stuff of that which he would be. They are that very nature of the divine, which he would take upon himself as a robe of spiritual light and beauty. The revolvings of the great wheel bring to him no sense of terror or giddiness. He rises above it in his soul and knows from above their divine law and their divine purpose. The difficulty of harmonizing the divine life with human living, of being in God and yet living in man, is the very difficulty that he is set here to solve and not to shun. He has learned that the joy, the peace, and the deliverance are an imperfect crown and no real possession if they do not form a state secure in itself, inalienable to the soul, not dependent on aloofness and inaction, but firm in the storm and the race and the battle, unsullied whether by the joy of the world or by its suffering. The ecstasy of the divine embrace will not abandon him because he obeys the impulse of divine love for God in humanity. Or if it seems to draw back from him for a while, he knows by experience that it is to try and test him still farther, so that some imperfection in his own way of meeting it may fall away from him. Personal salvation he does not seek, except as a necessity for the human fulfillment, and because he who is himself in bonds cannot easily free others, though to God nothing is impossible. For a heaven of personal joys, he has no hankerings, even as a hell of personal sufferings has for him no terrors. If there is an opposition between the spiritual life and that of the world, it is that gulf which he is here to bridge, that opposition which he is here to change into a harmony. If the world is ruled by the flesh and the devil, all the more reason that the children of immortality should be here to conquer it for God and the Spirit. If life is an insanity, then there are so many million souls to whom there must be brought the light of divine reason. If a dream, yet is it real within itself, to so many dreamers who must be brought either to dream nobler dreams or to awaken. Or if a lie, then the truth has to be given to the deluded. Nor if it be said that only by the luminous example of escape from the world can we help the world, shall we accept that dogma? Since the contrary example of great avatars is there to show that not only by rejecting the life of the world as it is can we help, but also and more by accepting and uplifting it. And if it is a play of the all existence, then we may well consent to play out our part in it with grace and courage. Well take delight in the game along with our divine playmate. But most of all, the view we have taken of the world forbids the renunciation of world existence, so long as we can be anything to God and man in their working out of its purposes. We regard the world not as an invention of the devil or a self-delusion of the soul, but as a manifestation of the divine, although as yet a partial because a progressive and evolutionary manifestation. Therefore, for us, renunciation of life cannot be the goal of life, nor rejection of the world the object for which the world was created. We seek to realize our unity with God, but for us that realization involves a complete and absolute recognition of our unity with man, and we cannot cut the two asunder. To use Christian language, the Son of God is also the Son of Man, and both elements are necessary to the complete Christhood. Or to use an Indian form of thought, the divine Narayana, of whom the universe is only one ray, is revealed and fulfilled in man. The complete man is Nara Narayana, and in that completeness, he symbolizes the supreme mystery of existence. Therefore, renunciation must be for us merely an instrument and not an object. Nor can it be the only or the chief instrument, since our object is the fulfillment of the divine in the human being. A positive aim, which cannot be reached by negative means. The negative means can only be for the removal of that which stands in the way of the positive fulfillment. It must be a renunciation, a complete renunciation of all that is other than and opposed to the divine self-fulfillment, and a progressive renunciation of all that is a lesser or only a partial achievement. We shall have no attachment to our life in the world. If that attachment exists, we must renounce it and renounce utterly. But neither shall we have any attachment to the escape from the world, to salvation, to the great self-annihilation. If that attachment exists, that also we must renounce, and renounce it utterly. Again, our renunciation must obviously be an inward renunciation, especially and above all, a renunciation of attachment and the craving of desire in the senses and the heart, of self-will in the thought and action, and of egoism in the center of the consciousness. For these things are the three knots by which we are bound to our lower nature. And if we can renounce these utterly, there is nothing else that can bind us. Therefore, attachment and desire must be utterly cast out. There is nothing in the world to which we must be attached, not wealth nor poverty, nor joy nor suffering, nor life nor death, nor greatness nor littleness, nor vice nor virtue, nor friend nor wife nor children, nor country, nor our work and mission, nor heaven nor earth, nor all that is within them or beyond them. And this does not mean that there is nothing at all that we shall love, nothing in which we shall take delight, for attachment is egoism in love, and not love itself. Desire is limitation, and insecurity in a hunger for pleasure and satisfaction, and not the seeking after the divine delight in things. A universal love we must have, calm, and yet eternally intense beyond the brief vehemence of the most violent passion. A delight in things, rooted in a delight in God that does not adhere to their forms, but to that which they conceal in themselves, and that embraces the universe without being caught in its meshes. Nirlipta, the divine Ananda in things, is nishkama and nirlipta, free from desire and therefore not attached. Self-will in thought and action has, as we have already seen, to be quite renounced if we would be perfect in the way of divine works. It is equally to be renounced if we are to be perfect in divine knowledge. This self-will means an egoism in the mind, which attaches itself to its preferences, its habits, its past or present formations of thought and view and will, because it regards them as itself or its own, weaves around them the delicate threads of I-ness and my-ness, and lives in them like a spider in its web. It hates to be disturbed, as a spider hates attack on its web and feels foreign and unhappy if transplanted to fresh viewpoints and formations, as a spider feels foreign in another web than its own. This attachment must be entirely excised from the mind. Not only must we give up the ordinary attitude to the world and life, to which the unawakened mind clings as its natural element, but we must not remain bound in any mental construction of our own or in any intellectual thought system or arrangement of religious dogmas or logical conclusions. We must not only cut asunder the snare of the mind and the senses, but flee also beyond the snare of the thinker, the snare of the theologian and the church builder, the meshes of the word and the bondage of the idea. All these are within us, waiting to wall in the spirit with forms. But we must always go beyond, always renounce the lesser for the greater, the finite for the infinite. We must be prepared to proceed from illumination to illumination, from experience to experience, from soul state to soul state, so as to reach the utmost transcendence of the divine and its utmost universality. Nor must we attach ourselves even to the truths we hold most securely, for they are but forms and expressions of the ineffable who refuses to limit himself to any form or expression. Always we must keep ourselves open to the higher word from above that does not confine itself to its own sense, and the light of the thought that carries in it its own opposites. But the center of all resistance is egoism, and this we must pursue into every covert and disguise, and drag it out and slay it, for its disguises are endless, and it will cling to every shred of possible self-concealment. Altruism and indifference are often its most effective disguises. So draped, it will riot boldly in the very face of the divine spies who are missioned to hunt it out. Here, the formula of the supreme knowledge comes to our help. We have nothing to do in our essential standpoint with these distinctions, for there is no I nor thou, but only one divine self, equal in all embodiments, equal in the individual and the group. And to realize that, to express that, to serve that, to fulfill that, is all that matters. Self-satisfaction and altruism, enjoyment and indifference, are not the essential thing. If the realization, fulfillment, service of the one self demands from us an action that seems to others self-service or self-assertion in the egoistic sense, or seems egoistic enjoyment and self-indulgence, that action we must do. We must be governed by the guide within rather than by the opinions of men. The influence of the environment works often with great subtlety. We prefer and put on almost unconsciously the garb which will look best in the eye that regards us from outside, and we allow a veil to drop over the eye within. We are impelled to drape ourselves in the vow of poverty, or in the garb of service, or in outward proofs of indifference and renunciation and a spotless sainthood, because that is what tradition and opinion demand of us. And so we can make best an impression on our environment. But all this is vanity and delusion. We may be called upon to assume these things, for that may be the uniform of our service, but equally, it may not. The eye of man outside matters nothing. The eye within is all.